This is a very funny thing. It's like the rich people generated the problem and poor people are paying the consequence. This is like, rich people go to a nice restaurant and have a very good meal, with a lot of champagne and wine and all the good stuff. And suddenly there is a poor guy going by and they say, you poor guy have to pay the bill. He didn't even taste the food. This is injustice. And this is what is happening with climate change.
Welcome to the 300 to 350 show, where we're following the road that leads to probably the most important talks that mankind has ever convened, the UN climate change talks in Copenhagen, which take place in December. There are two main requirements of a successful global climate change deal: that it is informed by the latest science, and that it is fair. Without fairness, there will be no deal. Nearly 200 countries need to reach agreement, and the majority of these countries are poor. So what progress has been made towards agreeing on what might be fair? Well, countries already agreed, back in 1992, when they signed up to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, that, and I quote, "the developed country parties should take the lead in combating climate change and the adverse effects thereof." Over the last 17 years, rich countries have demonstrably failed to honour this commitment, and instead, rich country emissions have continued to rise, and there has been very little money forthcoming to help poor countries deal with the impacts. This has led us to the very brink of climate catastrophe, and to a good deal of bad faith in the talks. No matter how rich countries try to spin it, the ball remains very firmly in their court. The UN Framework Convention also stipulates that parties should protect the climate system for the benefit of present and future generations of humankind on the basis of equity and in accordance with their common but differentiated responsibilities and capabilities. This is the same framework under which the UN talks are held to this day. So the basis for the discussion about what is fair already exists in long-established language. Equity, responsibility, capability, and developed country parties should lead. Aubrey Mayer has argued forcefully that the principle of equity implies that every person on the planet should end up with an equal right to pollute, and this has gained considerable support from all sides of the debate over the last two decades. More recently, the discussions have explored the meaning of the words responsibility and capability, and it is fairly unambiguous that the rich countries have both the greatest historical responsibility for creating the problem and the greatest capability in terms of financial resources to address the problem. In previous programmes, we've explored both the Greenhouse Development Rights Framework and the concept of climate debt, both of which propose ways of dividing up an emissions budget between countries and calculating amounts of the transfer of resources to poor countries. A few weeks ago, during the UN talks in Bonn, Oxfam International pitched in with their variant on these proposals and their vision of what might break the current deadlock. Here's Richard King, co-author of the report entitled "Hang Together or Separately."
The paper was really a way of trying to propose a way forward based on this double duty for rich countries. The first part of that double duty being that they have to cut their own emissions to 40% below 1990 levels by 2020 in aggregate, and we think there's a way of dividing that up amongst them so they each take on their own different levels of responsibility and capability. But in essence, as a group, rich countries have to reduce by 40%. The second part is that that alone is not going to keep us below 2 degrees, so we also need to see reductions in developing countries. So the second part of the double duty is that the developed countries, the rich countries, must also finance the reductions in poorer countries. And we think we need to see in the region of about $150 billion to cover both mitigation emissions cuts and for poor countries to protect themselves from a changing climate.
The paper seems very clear and might just be worth explaining for listeners. Why do you think the poor nations are kind of right? You know, you describe the deadlock, and both rich countries and poor countries presumably think they're right, but why do you think poor countries are right?
Because rich countries are, at the moment, are responsible for about three-quarters of all the carbon dioxide currently in the atmosphere. So historically, they've not only emitted far more than developing countries, but they've also got rich off the back of it. So not only do they have the greatest responsibility, they also have the greatest economic capability. So from that background, we think rich countries have by far the largest obligation, whereas many poor countries still have development and poverty alleviation as their rightful number one priority.
Right, and presumably under the convention, rich countries kind of signed up to this idea that they had a responsibility to move first, which goes back to 1990. So there's a kind of outstanding duty to act, which they appear to be trying to avoid.
Absolutely. So the first commitment period of the Kyoto Protocol is due up in 2012. And some rich countries have reached their obligations under that, but the vast majority haven't, and some haven't even been signed up to it. But since that convention was first signed, in the last decade, we've really seen the urgency of climate change has become much more apparent as the new science develops. So in this next commitment period, we need to see that level of ambition increase dramatically. And currently, rich countries are not proposing anything like the 40% that we're suggesting they need to do in aggregate.
Yeah, and I was seeing some figures in your report about how some of the rich countries have actually increased their emissions. Canada, Australia and the US and New Zealand all increasing their emissions very significant amounts since 1990, when they should have been getting them down.
Absolutely. I mean, I think Europe is possibly the exception, and we're saying in this report that we think that they should cut their emissions by 44% on 1990 levels by 2020. But even Europe, which is one of the more progressive regions, they're currently only talking about a commitment of about 20 to 30% reduction. So their ambition is nowhere near the level needed. We're saying the US needs to deliver 45% reduction, and they're currently in the House of Representatives talking about 14%. And that's just the first part of the double duty. On the financial side, financing emissions cuts in developing countries, none of these countries are proposing anything like enough, and we're really seeing a woefully inadequate commitment on the finance side.
Right. I mean, in terms of the majority of the countries at the table, largely poor countries, of course, we are seeing some kind of emerging consensus, it appears to me, in the Kyoto Protocol track about the need for at least a 40% cut as a group by developed countries. There's both a proposal by this Association of Small Island States saying 45% cut, and at least 40% cut, I think, was tabled by a group of 40 developing countries. So that does appear to be emerging as some kind of consensus, and you've used that 40% figure for 2020 as well, and used the Responsibility and Capacity Index to divide that up between rich nations?
Yes, so we're saying that 40% for rich countries is a minimum. We'd obviously like to see them go further than that, but at the moment that's not looking politically feasible. But as a minimum, we want that 40% reduction from 1990 levels from rich countries. And then the way we've suggested we divide that up between rich countries is based on principles of responsibility and capability. So responsibility for historic emissions across all Kyoto gases back to 1990, when the first IPCC assessment report was published and climate change was widely on the agenda, and also economic capability, so countries' gross national income and their ability to pay for emissions reductions.
Okay, we should probably look at those definitions of responsibility and capacity a little bit. So 1990, yeah, I guess, was when the convention was also signed. But Bolivia and South Africa, for example, are using much longer time frames, which would presumably increase the amount of kind of responsibility and debt, if you liked, from rich to the poor in terms of climate change.
Yeah, so we're saying 1990 is the latest that we think you should go back, and we've just done our indicative calculations using those numbers. Now, obviously, you can go back further, and developed countries, rich countries, have got rich over the last 100, 150 years off the back of those emissions since the Industrial Revolution. So there's certainly a case for taking your emissions figures back further. We just used 1990 because we wanted complete and accurate data across all greenhouse gas emissions, whereas going back further, it's a bit more difficult to get the full basket of emissions included.
In terms of the capacity, it's roughly how much gross national income the country has, but then it kind of ignores anything under $9,000 per year. Can you explain why that figure is chosen? You're referring to it as a development threshold?
What we've basically said is that for each country, we ignore the wealth for each person below $9,000. So it takes into account the income distribution within a country. So we think even within rich countries, there are poor people who shouldn't be responsible for financing the emissions cuts. Now, $9,000 per person is roughly 50% more than what's widely acknowledged as a global poverty line. So we're talking about a level of global medium income. So these are people who are comfortably above the poverty line, and we didn't want to use a poverty line because people above a poverty line could potentially fall back in it. So these are people who have realised comfortable development, but certainly not excessive level of development. So only people with wealth above that level should be responsible for paying the price.
Do you know anything about where the discussions on this are in terms of responsibility and capacity at the UN talks?
Well, we're seeing the general idea of responsibility and capability gain a lot more ground, especially amongst some of the developing countries. There's also, as you previously mentioned, the idea of a carbon debt, which is also gaining momentum. And when you actually look at the figures, the two approaches are broadly compatible in terms of what they result for in terms of emissions reductions needed. The reason we've just added capability on as well as this historic responsibility is partly because in the Climate Convention, it does mention a principle of common but differentiated responsibility and respective capability. And we also think that a slight limitation of the carbon debt approach is it's based on per capita emissions, which makes forward accounting and working out what's an equitable per capita level of emissions going forward is actually quite difficult to do.
Okay, that raises a question about how the Responsibility Capacity Index changes over time, because presumably as we move forward, developing countries will be taking up a lot more of the emissions budget as their economies grow. Do they have to pay more for the mitigation and adaptation actions as we move forward in time?
Well, at the moment, we're proposing this just for the next commitment period, so we don't want to see developing countries taking on binding commitments, but they do need to have the finance in place from rich countries to take on mitigation actions which are nationally appropriate, so emissions cuts which are in line with their national priorities for development. Obviously, as we move into next commitment periods, then we are going to see the goalposts change, and that's the point when we need to have those conversations. But at the moment, we're just talking about an indicative way forward of breaking through the current impasse in the negotiations.
I think you've already mentioned what the kind of sums that are needed. I think straight away we're pretty much talking about $150 billion a year. Does that rise as time goes on? Presumably there's a greater need for adaptation as we move forward and climate change does kind of start to bite.
Yes, so at the moment we're talking about a minimum of $50 billion for adaptation per year and $100 billion for emissions cuts for developing countries to be financed by rich countries. Now, obviously, the longer we leave it, the more the cost is going to rise, and not just the cost, but the people's lives are going to be affected, and people are going to increasingly be affected by climate-related disasters. Nicola Stern has predicted that if we don't take action, then in the future the global economic cost could be something in the range of 5 to 20% of global GDP. So there really is an economic imperative to act sooner rather than later, quite apart from the moral obligation to do it, because it is the poor people who are getting affected first and worst by climate change.
Right. To put those figures into some kind of perspective, we've seen the financial bailout, and we've also know what the world spends on the military every year. Can we foresee the rich world getting to grips with these kind of numbers?
Well, the track record is not good, but we hope so. So in terms of those two other things you mentioned, we're talking about $150 billion here, and to put it in perspective, we've seen $4 trillion spent bailing out rich countries from the economic crisis, and $1.3 trillion every year on global military spending. So it's really a sort of drop in the ocean in comparison. And I think the other point to make is that a lot of this money is actually of the $150 billion is actually quite a good way of stimulating economies and getting out of the current recession. I mean, investments in renewable technologies both at home and abroad can create thousands and thousands of jobs, as well as putting ourselves on a low carbon path to development. So I think in many ways it does kill two birds with one stone, and it's just a question of people coming around and realising that.
Right. How do you think this money should be raised in a way that is kind of reliable and predictable?
We're proposing something which we're calling the Global Mitigation Finance Mechanism, which would be set up under the current UN system, and that would basically match carbon permits from rich countries to finance nationally appropriate emissions cuts in developing countries. So at the moment, rich countries get carbon permits for free, and what we're proposing is that rather than just giving them to them in the next commitment period, we think they should be sold to rich countries either under a system of auctions or levies. And that would, as you say, provide a reliable and predictable source of finance, which could then go into this global mechanism, and then that would fund nationally appropriate actions in developing countries.
Right, and the Norwegians have had a similar proposal on the table for a while, but they're not really talking about the scale of funds that we actually need. But the idea is kind of in the air already. They just needs to be scaled up.
It needs to be scaled up, and it needs to happen sooner rather than later. And crucially, I think it needs to happen under the UN system. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about also setting it up under a new body or under the World Bank, but we really think that the UN system is the only fair way of proceeding with this.
And do you want to just say a little bit how the money is allocated and how that financial mechanism would be governed?
It would be governed under the UN system, and then what we're proposing is that developing countries put forward their proposals for national emissions cut plans, which include nationally appropriate mitigation action. And for all but the very poorest countries, we think those should be economy-wide. So there's a group of countries which are the least developed countries, the small island states, and sort of the poorest of the rest, and we think they should receive 100% of their financing from this global fund. There's a small group of richer non-annex one countries at the very top range, and we actually think that they should fund all of their own proposed appropriate emissions cuts. And then there's a big swathe of countries in the middle which would receive some funding from this global fund in line with their own available economic capability.
So the idea is that this all fits in with the pathway that has been mapped out by the Bali Action Plan, I presume.
Yes.
And the governance structure is similar to that being proposed by G77 and China?
I'm not familiar with the details of that proposal. But we basically, I mean, and it would be for the UN system to sort out the exact governance arrangement. But basically it needs to be governed by all countries in a fair and equitable way, in a similar manner to the new Global Adaptation Fund Board.
You're saying that the majority of the 40% cuts for rich countries need to be made at home. Is that wording good enough? I mean, that could just be 51%, which is pretty much what is on the table from the EU, for example, right now. Don't we need to see a higher commitment from developed countries to making all of those cuts at home?
Well, it's certainly in rich countries' own interest to make the most of their cuts at home, because, I mean, that's where we're going to see investment in new technologies come from. Now, we haven't actually put a figure on what we mean by majority, and there are various ways of dividing up sort of how much should be done domestically and how much could be done elsewhere. But the bottom line is that 40% aggregate of Annex 1 does need to be done in Annex 1 countries.
I mean, it seems to me that there's a logic to this that is kind of undeniable, and it uses the existing language from the Convention and the Bali Action Plan. How much longer can the rich countries ignore this argument, and how are they currently attempting to wriggle their way out of this?
Well, to be honest, we've seen in the last two bond negotiation sessions ahead of the Copenhagen conference at the end of the year that rich countries really just aren't engaging a lot of the time. And it's increasingly frustrating and it's increasingly worrying, because we really do need to see something by the end of the year if we're going to avoid catastrophic climate change. And at present, the level of ambition is just not there. I mean, hopefully proposals such as the Oxfam one will get taken up as a way through the impasse, but at the moment there's precious little reason to be optimistic that we're going to see what we need by the end of the year.
Do you feel that the majority world narrative is being lost in all this to some extent, and that we're falling prey to the rich world narrative, and that they could almost blame this whole situation on the developing world?
I think there's potential for them to continue to push that narrative, but I really don't see that it's in any way credible. I mean, as we've mentioned in this paper and elsewhere, the rich countries have the vast majority of the historic responsibility. They also have the vast majority of the economic capability. They haven't taken on commitments from the previous commitment period, so quite how they can rationalise pinning the blame on developing countries is, it beggars belief, to be honest.
Is there anything you want to say by way of rounding off?
I guess we just need to acknowledge the fact that already we're seeing people in poor countries impacted by climate change, both in terms of sudden onset disasters, which is we're predicting going to increase by about 50% by 2015, which is the year of the Millennium Development Goals, and we think about 375 million people by that time could well be impacted by climate-related disasters. But also acknowledging that is very much the tip of the iceberg, and already now, before global warming has reached above 1 degree Celsius above pre-industrial levels, poor people are already affected by also the slow onset disasters. So like, farmers in Uganda are gambling with their planting seasons. They don't know when they plant their crops, whether they're going to be swept away by heavy rains or affected by drought. So it's poor people who are being hit first and worst by the current climate, and who stand the most to lose in the future.
And you've got kind of teams out on the ground worldwide and who are kind of dealing with this kind of stuff every day.
Yeah, unfortunately we're seeing it more and more in our work, and we are seeing it all around the world. So yes, it's a very real issue which people are dealing with already.
That was Richard King of Oxfam, who is a co-author of the recently published Hang Together or Separately report. Like other development charities, Oxfam has made climate change a focus of its work, as it threatens to undermine progress in many other areas, including the global aspirations enshrined in the Millennium Development Goals. Its current campaign, Here and Now, aims to remind people how the poor are already feeling the impacts of climate change in their daily lives. So we're going to end this week's programme with Ricardo Navarro from Friends of the Earth, El Salvador, describing the impacts of climate change on his country and explaining why climate change is an issue of justice. This is an excerpt from a longer interview we will be broadcasting later in the year. Next week we're going to Brussels to challenge some European commissioners on their current lack of ambition. But in the meantime, for references relating to this week's programme or to hear the show again, you can visit the Climate Radio Archive at www.climateradio.org. Thanks for listening.
In El Salvador, we are experiencing the problem of climate change. Sometimes as in a slow process, sometimes in very dramatic ways. For example, when we had a Hurricane Mitch that was in 1998, 12,000 people were killed in 3 days. Most of them were killed in Honduras, second Nicaragua, third El Salvador, and fourth Guatemala. But about 4 years ago, we had another, not hurricane, but big storm. No winds, just the rains, and just it paralyzed the whole country. Those are the dramatic ways. But also, we have things that don't look very dramatic. For example, last year, the rainy season started normally, and the government said that it's time to plant. And suddenly, when people planted, it stopped raining. And then it went without raining for several weeks. And then all the little seeds were destroyed. That doesn't make the international news because it doesn't look dramatic. But what does it mean? It means that for the country, that we have to import food from Guatemala, Nicaragua, United States, whatever. For the local people, it means that their whole survival is threatened because they plant in their season some of the crops they eat themselves and the rest they sell to buy the other goods that they need to survive, you know, like clothing, schooling, health, whatever. And suddenly you have no money, nothing. What do you do the rest of the year? I mean, it's very dramatic for the individual, although it doesn't make international news, you know. We're suffering the consequences of overconsumption. That climate change is generated by an excessive amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, which is the result of excessive levels of consumption. And the problem is that the people who are suffering the consequences are people who have not consumed, people who are vulnerable. You know, this is a very funny thing. It's like the rich people generated the problem and poor people are paying the consequence. This is like, rich people go to a nice restaurant and have a very good meal, you know, with a lot of champagne and wine and all the good stuff. And suddenly there is a poor guy going by and they say, you poor guy have to pay the bill. He didn't even taste the food. Can you believe it? This is injustice. And this is what is happening with climate change. And we have to understand that we have to find a new way of living where we can survive as a species, because this climate change problem is going to take us, is taking us into a suicidal path. Eventually, all of us are going to lose. Because here in Europe, for example, you may not have big hurricanes, but you may have big heat waves. And only God knows what's going to happen, you know. In Finland, for example, they are saying, oh, we're going to have, Mediterranean climate in the future. Mediterranean climate with tropical insects. And tropical insects are going to generate a lot of health problems in Finland because we in El Salvador, we are more or less used to mosquitoes, more or less. When mosquitoes come and they bite the Finnish people, they are not, you know, that's going to be painful. And beetles and things like that are going to destroy their forests. So what does that mean? Everyone is going to suffer. What happens is like in the Titanic, you know, when people, the first people who drown, the people who are in the lower parts, but eventually the people who are in the upper floors are also going to suffer the consequence. So I think it's in the interest of everybody to try to promote more justice. And this is an important issue, that the solution to climate change, it goes through a justice movement. This is very important.